I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What is virtue? How do you acquire it? How do you live a flourishing, examined life? These are the questions your high school students could be asking at Princeton University this summer at the Witherspoon Institute's seminar on the moral life and the classical tradition. Accomplished university faculty engage students on discussions of the big questions, drawing on thinkers like C.S. Lewis and Peter Kraft, and using a Christian framework to stress the importance of the family and human dignity. Students seeking admission to the seminar should be earnest in their desire to further their education as well as their moral formation. Former students of this program have gone on to graduate from Harvard, Princeton, Yale, and many other colleges and have formed strong friendships over the course of the week-long course. The seminar for men runs from June 17th to June 23rd, and the seminar for women runs June 24th to June 30th. See the Witherspoon Institute's website for application details at winst.org. That's winst.org. Hello and welcome to Forma, a podcast featuring conversations with authors, teachers, creators, and community leaders who are carefully contemplating the nature and practice of classical education. I'm David Kern, and on this episode, I'm really excited about this because this guest is one of my favorite Circe people. My favorite Circe orbit people, I guess, is the better way of putting it. He's been around for a long time. Since I was a little kid and attending conferences with my family, John Hodges has been a part of the Circe world. He's been speaking at Circe conferences and writing for us and just generally being a good friend of Circe for so long now that I don't even know if I can keep track of it. He's the director of the Center for Western Studies, a sort of gap year program for kids who are out of high school, but looking for something to kind of prepare them for the rest of their life, and in particular for college. The Center for Western Studies is what they call an experiment in education, and their goal is to offer students two things: a Christian view of the world and a study of the ideas that shaped Western civilization. So they get together in Memphis, Tennessee, where Mr. Hodges lives, along with six other faculty members, and they discuss great books, great ideas, great art, great music, and best of all, perhaps, well, maybe not best of all, but one of the great things is they get to travel to Europe every spring. So they'll go to Oxford, go to Paris, and get to actually see where so much of the great art of the Western world was created. If you want to learn more about the center, you can go to centerws.com. And at the end of this episode, Mr. Hodges talks a little bit more about the program. So I highly recommend you stick around for that at the end. But in this conversation, we talked, Mr. Hodges and I talked about music, which is his primary realm of expertise. We talked about people like me, the musically limited, as it were, and how to teach, and how, for people who don't know a lot about music and who aren't gifted in music, teaching music to our kids and our students can be scary. So I asked him what he recommends for that, and that's kind of where we began. But we also talked about the role of composer study. We talked about pop music a little bit. We talked about helping students learn to love music. We talked about why the word classical, in reference to classical music, is not the best word. And we talked about pieces of music that Mr. Hodges recently rediscovered that he's really been really surprised by and that he's been enjoying. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. If you don't feel up to the task of teaching music, or if you love music and are a concert pianist, whatever it is, I think this conversation will be of great interest to you. Mr. Hodges is so insightful when it comes to music, and you can tell that he really loves it, and that love just comes through and is inspiring and instructive at once. So without further ado, I will kick it over to my interview with Mr. John Hodges of the Center for Western Studies. And I began by asking him the first question that I brought up there for the musically limited. I don't want to say the musically uninclined, but the musically limited, so to speak. Teaching music can be scary, frightening, can be kind of a waste, not a wasteland, but a wilderness. I can feel that way. So how do you recommend someone approach teaching their children that way? And let's just assume for the sake of conversation right now, that it's say a homeschooling parent who knows that they want their children to be musically educated, to be able to play an instrument or read music or know what they're listening to at the very least when they listen to a classic piece.
Yeah.
But you know, maybe that person like me had a very limited skill set and so kind of steered away from music. So what would you could just talk to me. What would you tell me to do?
Well, David, well, this is a very interesting question because, it's one that I've actually addressed all my life, trying to figure out how it is to re-engage the general public with their own sort of musical heritage. It's a multifaceted problem. First off, I think people love things when they see the value in them. And so they pursue things when they love them. Mm. Maybe that's the better thing. Mm. But, you know, if we don't pursue something, it's probably because we don't have an affection for it specifically. And if you don't have an affection for the thing, it's probably because you haven't actually gotten to know it very well. Mm. Well, in the case of sort of classical, what we call classical music, which by the way is a terrible word for it because, well, let me hang on to that a second.
Okay. I'll write a note down to ask you about that.
ask me about the word classical. What I'm thinking is people generally don't see the value in the music. So why go to all the trouble of sort of exposing yourself to or wasting time with, an obscure Bach toccata or, you know, Mozart symphony or something when there's all this exciting music that really does speak to me, you know, right here at hand on my iTunes account or whatever.
Yeah.
And I can be immediately enjoying the thing, right? Why should I work at trying to enjoy something that obviously doesn't touch me, doesn't relate to me. I'm not relating to it. Mm. And part of it is that we just are an immediate culture. We want things fast. It's not enough to have fast food in your microwave. You want to go to a fast food restaurant, though, to have somebody else cook it for you. And then, of course, that's not fast enough. We don't want to actually leave our cars. We want to just drive through the Starbucks or the whatever we're going through. Anyway, we like things to come very quickly. And there are things in the world that, frankly, don't come quickly, but are worth the effort. And classical art and music are one of those things. The second thing is we don't really have a connection with our own history very much anymore. We don't like to think of ourselves backward toward our grandparents. We want to think of ourselves looking forward to the future. You know, the future is exciting. The next thing that's coming down the road is what's important. And so why bother with things from way in the past like that? Just let them die. That's a personal preference approach to the whole thing. And I think that's at the source too. That's another facet of this problem. We are living in a day when our personal preferences, for the most part, are sacrosanct in people's minds. If you ask me to change my tastes about something, you're actually asking me to change my soul, my person. You're in a sense critiquing my person.
Yeah.
And that's not what people who love classical music are trying to do. But it's a sort of assumption that our preferences are essential to our being. And so don't ask me to change my preferences. Those are the things that I live by. What I want is what makes me me. See? So if somebody says, well, put down that Beyonce record and listen to this obscure Palestrina motet, you'd say, well, you're just asking me to be different. You like that. I like this. Let's just sort of in true libertarian fashion, you know, to each his own, chacun a son goût, you know, to each his own taste. And leave it like that, right? So there's no questioning about the quality of the thing being talked about. So that's the mountain that we have to climb before we can get to the point where we're actually saying, this is what music is, this is what it's been in the hands of masters in the past, and this is how you might engage with it. It's like a language, you see. It's like learning French. You're learning a whole new language. You're learning different words for things, for meanings and ideas and objects. And in music, it's like that too. It's just that when we, you know, literature is easy in a sense to study because it's already in the language that we know. It may have words that we don't know, but generally speaking, reading English makes it possible or at least feasible for us to read Shakespeare. But we don't know the language of music, so it's like when you turn on Bach or something, it's in a language like Swahili or something, and you don't really have any idea why those sounds go with anything.
So when you talk about the language of music, two kinds of, I guess, two categories of knowledge sort of pop into my head. One is the way that little kids learn to speak English or French or whatever, where they don't actually know the structure or the constructs or the rules, but they learn that certain sounds mean certain things and they begin to put them together. And, you know, it's kind of, there's something innate about it and they don't, you know, it doesn't have to be like a, anything, but there's nothing formal about how they're learning it really.
Right.
That seems like that's sort of like just, the language of music being where you're just spending time with the music and the certain, then the sounds become familiar. And then there is the more formal structural elements of language where, you know, kids sit in a classroom or in a classroom settings, if it's at home or something like that, and they learn the more formal aspects of the language. Which of those two things are you primarily speaking of when you talk about that?
Well, actually, I guess I'm speaking about both because you do kind of want to expose yourself to the music as a child might listen to words as an infant listen to words,
right.
Slowly grow in a kind of intuitive fashion with it. Mm-hmm. But there's a point in that sort of study where you have to learn to read music, or you have to learn to understand form, or recognize the variations in melodies or chord constructions and things like that. The technical aspect of it all,
right?
So. Right. When you're 3 years old, you might be delighted by the sounds of music. But when you're 7 years old, you might be asked to sit down at the piano and learn that this is middle C and so on.
So,
and you have to learn how to read what it is that you've been listening to.
So let's say we have, I don't know, for the sake of conversation, a teenager who who maybe grew up in a home. Well, let's just say, I don't know, there's so many different ways we could so many different angles I could go on this, but let's just say we have a teenager who you're trying to teach, or you're trying to help them learn to love what we'll, for the sake of conversation, currently call classical music. And you're trying to help them love that, and they don't yet, and maybe you feel like you were lacking in, you know, your instruction for them when they were younger was lacking. Would you recommend that their studies be primarily more formally based, where you're teaching them the various elements and to speak the formal language of music, so that there is that foundation for them to grasp onto as they hopefully will learn to love it? Or would you kind of treat them, well, I hesitate to put it this way, but treat them more like you would an infant learning a language, where you're just kind of trying to immerse them in the sounds and the kind of world of the music? For the novice who you want to learn to love music, which of those two ways would you pursue it, do you think?
Well, it's a very good question. If I were the parent of the child, then I think I would want to take the approach that most classical education takes and say, let's teach this young child at the point that he's most, you know, dry, spongy, important things that he'll be able to use as tools later on to properly appreciate music. So I would think piano lessons at a young age would be a good idea. And when I say young age, I mean about the same time that they learn how to read. So if they learn to read at 3 or 4 or 5, terrific. If they learn to read at 7, fine. But it's a matter of actually reading. It's looking at the music and reading what it is and making that sound come out of your hands somehow, right? Either recorder or piano or voice singing or whatever. But to connect up what the thing looks like on the page with the sound that comes out. But I'm not the parent of most of these kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would require a lot of sort of discipline of the child, because he's not going to want to do it. It's typical of children at that age. No, mom, I don't want to play the piano. I want to go out and play with my friends, right? Well, you got to do a half an hour at the piano and then you can go play with your, it's like that. Mm-hmm. Well, it's in order that you instill in them at a young age the tools, like I said, necessary to be able to make sense of music when they get older and they can actually engage with it intellectually and emotionally and all those things. Well, then they have the tools to accomplish it. But I'll tell you what I've done in the past. When I was working as a church musician, I knew that the next generation really didn't have much in the way of musical skills going on. And of course, we had a children's choir that we ran, and we had other things for the children. But I also did this. I did what we call a Rhythm U concert, which was a sort of patterned after the old Leonard Bernstein young people's concerts.
Yeah.
I would pull an orchestra together, a bunch of my buddies from the Memphis Symphony, and bring them over and rehearse with them for an hour and a half from, say, 5 o'clock to 6:30. And then give them a dinner break, and then at 7:30 do a concert for the kids. And so it was all in one night. You know, they came over and rehearsed, and we just did a 45-minute program, something like that.
Yeah.
And in the program, because you're taking into consideration the attention span of the young people and so on, but in the program, I would pick pieces of music that could easily be connected up with other aspects of their lives so that they had a sort of pathway into the music, you see. And for example, I'll just give you a couple of examples. I did Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet fantasy overture. And it's got in it this sword fight theme. Bum, ta-ga-dum, bum, 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 ta-da, bum, 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 ta-da, bum, 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 bum. And it's very exciting and bubbly and driving and so on. And I got two actors from the local theater who were experts in stage fighting to come on in sort of Romeo and Juliet costumes and do a sword fight up and down the aisles. While we did the music, see. So beforehand, I told them.
I bet that went over well.
They were screaming and they loved it, see. What I wanted was for them to see that that's what this is. I wanted them to visualize what the music is doing. There are no words to this music, but it's very clear that that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then it has the famous love theme, da-da, da-da-da, da-da, in it. And when we got to that, I had a guy and a girl in Romeo and Juliet costume. I put the girl up in the balcony, and I put the guy down on the floor, and he played mimed the balcony scene from Romeo and Juliet. So they get a visual connection to what it is that they're hearing. See? Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of these kind of concerts, I did that. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones right off the top of my head. I did a Mozart Rondo one time, a French horn concerto movement. And I mocked up cards, big cards that had the letters A, B, and C on them. And I showed them how a rondo works, because it's in the form A, B, A, C, A, D, A. And I showed them what the different pieces of it what A sounded like, what B sounded like. We just played them separately and talked about them, you see. And then when we got into the piece of music, I said, okay, now I need volunteers to come up here and pick out the card that we're hearing. You know, are we hearing A now? Are we hearing B? So I got the kids involved, and they actually held up the card A while the A thing was playing. And when we moved to the B section, he knew to put that down, and somebody else picked up the B card, you know. And, oh, okay. In other words, I'm hearing the structure of this piece. I'm not just sitting there letting it sort of bounce off my ears and comparing it to the latest Jay-Z song in my head. Why isn't this more like that, you know? Because my musical experience is just this idea of having sound bombarding me, and how do I feel when I hear it? You know, that's the extent of it. But what I wanted them to see was that Mozart was actually saying, this shape of things is beautiful. It's an abstract shape that has a certain symmetry to it and beauty to it. And they got it. They began to see that the music wasn't just making noises. It was going in a certain progression, in a certain order. So anyway, I'm going on and on, but yes. I bet I did 12.
Interesting.
And I think my hope was that once or twice a year, the kids in our church would have an experience with classical music that they would later in life look back on and say, you know, I listened to a piece. I went to a concert one time. It was a lot of fun. I have good experiences with classical music, you see, other than my mom put me in a tie and I had to go and sit and, you know, in a hard seat and listen to something I didn't understand and
want
to play baseball or something. I'm just saying, for the young people, I think there are two approaches. You can think about what you would do with your own children. And I think in that case, you probably want to shape them some and give them the tools necessary. But on the general level, I think we need to teach the young people to be able to listen to what are the elements of music? What is melody? What is harmony? What is rhythm? What is form? And when they get those definitions in their heads, they might actually start looking for those things. And the genius of composers is reflected in those things, in the music that they listen to. And what I find is with my students, they eventually start to be kind of bored with a lot of the stuff that is popular. Because there isn't much to it. When you learn to analyze music, you listen to this, you know, latest pop song, and you think, well, yeah, it's cute, but it's nothing. There's nothing there. It's like candy, cotton candy. It just disappears. Well, kind of. There's a sort of fun rhythm to it, maybe, and then that's it. You think, well, that's done, and it was repetitive, and it didn't have any progression. It didn't actually develop any. He didn't develop any ideas. He didn't connect the melody that he's singing to any of the meaning of the words, you know? So, I mean, you start looking for things like that and you see it all just sort of become, it's gaseous. It disappears.
At what point would you, or how early, I guess, would you start formally naming the structural elements of music? So, like, you could probably, a child could, I mean, now I'm no music instructor or whatever, but I would think that, as is the case with literature or any number of other subjects, a child could start learning the elements of a piece of music before they actually are naming what that element is.
Would you
early on be naming, you know, the different parts of the different elements of music, or would you let them kind of discover them and learn what they are before you start naming them? Is there a good strategy for that?
I think you want to attach their hearts to the beauty of it intuitively before you start naming it all. My instinct as an educator is to show them something and then, in a sense, use their own natural curiosity to fill in those kinds of gaps. So, you think, well, you show them something and they go, that's kind of fun. That's kind of fascinating. And you maybe have to point out one or two things for them or something, but see how it kind of goes up here and down there. Well, that's true. It does, doesn't it? Does it do that again? You know how it is. When you're teaching somebody about poetry, you do the same thing or painting or lots of things. But instead of saying, here's a list of things that you need to know and they're completely disconnected from any experience you've ever had, and now I'm going to give you an experience and see if you can connect them up. I think I'd do it the other way around, especially because music is so intuitive. So there's a heart attachment that you want first, I would think.
What role, you know, there's especially in the world of Charlotte Mason education, there's a big emphasis on composer study for young kids. Now, I don't know everything about that. I'm not the Charlotte Mason expert that say Karen Glass or Cindy Rollins or someone is, but what role would you say that actual composer study, I guess semi-formal composer study should play in teaching young kids music? And I guess young kids is kind of a relative term, but and I don't mean to pitch you against Charlotte Mason, so you know, step lightly. No, I guess if you disagree.
No, not at all. I really don't know a whole lot about Charlotte Mason's approach, and so I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't be critiquing it in any way, no matter what my opinion is. I would be more interested in engaging with the music itself, maybe than the sort of factual information about the composers. That's a secondary thing. If the student is old enough that he's trying to learn something about the history of music, well then, yeah, I guess that would make some sense. The way I've done it is I lay out some periods of music, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. general historical periods. And then within each of those periods, I'll say these are the composers that are most sort of well known in each of those periods. Mm-hmm. And in that case, then they are associating, Prokofiev with 20th century music. You're associating, you know, Mozart with 18th century music and so on. That would be useful in history. But I'm not sure how important it is to know birth and death dates of, you know, Shostakovich. If what you're really trying to do is teach them something about how music works. Mm-hmm. So it's useful. It's a secondary thing, it would seem to me.
Like you said, I don't know a ton about Charlotte Mason's approach there. So anybody that, you know, so I'm going to be getting messages from people saying I got it wrong. So okay. I'm just going to state for the record, I'm not
And I'm not critiquing it at all. I think it's great to know about composers. So don't get me wrong. I think that's wonderful. But if the question is trying to understand music, then I don't see that's the first thing.
Right.
If you think that, I mean, I guess if you really saw in your students an interest in personalities and biography and like that, and the gateway into what it is that they did, well then, yeah, that might be a gateway toward it, but it seems like the subject itself would be the music and not so much the biography.
Yeah, and I would suspect that the Charlotte Mason approach probably involves not just reading about them, but probably listening to many pieces by the composers.
Sure.
So I'm curious, what are some good pieces of music, of classical music, and we'll continue to call it that until we discuss that. Why you don't like that word? some good pieces of music that it seems like children, and especially young children, love that are good gateway pieces. You know, for my kids, they love the Leonard Bernstein concerts. They love the Carnival of the Animals.
Love it. Sure. Perfect.
So every time we drive somewhere, whether it's the grandparents or church or a long trip, they want to listen to the Carnival of the Animals or even the Peter and the Wolf.
Peter and the Wolf.
Yeah. And so there's even particular sections of the Carnival of the Animals that they are like, each of them has their own sections that they love.
Yeah.
So are there other pieces similarly that seems like that children love that you would recommend?
You know, really talking about children's education and music is almost not in my field. So I probably am not the best guy to talk about that. What I think is great about Peter and the Wolf is, first of all, it's delightful music. It's just spectacularly accessible and delightful music. And it's a great introduction to the various instruments. You know, Peter is played by the strings and the bird is played by the flute and the duck, you know, with the oboe and so on. And the fantastic, fantastic clarinet part. For the cat. Absolute genius. So it's a great way not only for them to be engaged, as I was talking about, a sort of extra musical reference point, like these animals and the story, to engage them with the sounds that they're actually hearing. But also, it's a sort of introduction to the various instruments. That's what a flute sounds like. That's what an oboe sounds like. That's what a clarinet sounds like, and so on. The same thing with Carnival of the Animals, only it's more subtle. It's very funny. The music is very funny. The roar of the lion, you know, and the I've always, you know, the bass solo, bum bum ba, beep ba ba ba, bum bum ba. It's hysterically funny. It's it's this great huge animal trying to do a little ballet step. Very, you know, it's delightful and clever and silly and all of that. And the aquarium music is so watery and, you know, pre-impressionist almost. Kind of music. It's wonderful. So anyway, they get a terrific experience, I think, in those things. And the fact that there's an external reference point makes it a little easier for them. Eventually, what you want to do, though, is get them to listening to music without that external reference point. What I mean is there is what they call pure music, and there's what they call program music. Program music is music that has this external storyline. And it was very big in the 19th century, early 20th century music. And so a lot of the music that we know that we call classical has a program to it. Till Eulenspiegel or the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique or even Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, which was really the beginning of it all. Beethoven's Sixth Symphony is called the Pastoral Symphony and has in it, built into it, all these sort of nature sounds and nature experiences. Sound of water going over, going down the brook, you know, over the stones in the brook in the second movement, or the lightning storm, or the rain, and so on. All these various things that Beethoven sort of wrote into his music. It's a pure music piece, but it has these extra references that he brought in, and that sort of inspires the 19th century, I think, to start writing more and more program music. But there's all sorts of music that is pure music. You find it in the Mozart symphonies, the Haydn symphonies, the classical music, what they call truly classical music, music of the 18th century, or Bach's keyboard pieces, or his Brandenburg concertos, orchestral pieces, orchestral suites, various things like that. They have their internal reference points. That is, the music is its own entity. It's not speaking about something outside of itself. It's speaking only within its own language, as it were. Eventually what you want, I think, is for people to be able to listen to pure music and make sense of that. And for that, it requires more and more, technical understanding.
There's more subtlety.
That's right. And form and very theme and variations, understanding how a particular musical idea is introduced and then it's developed.
It seems like it seems like you have to learn the language of that particular piece even more, you know, going even beyond the language of music in general. Is that true?
No, I don't think it's that particular piece. It's a understanding of the language of music that makes it possible for you to unlock a particular piece.
Okay. Okay.
Can I give you a quick example? This is going to sound
sick. Please.
I'm singing these things. It's not really fair to the listeners, but listen to my awful voice. But there's a famous.
If I sang, that would be awful.
There's a famous Paganini etude for violin that goes. It starts. Bum da 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 di da 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 di da 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 di da 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 di da, like that, has that figure, and it's Rachmaninoff took that in the 20th century. Rachmaninoff took that little melody that Paganini wrote some 50 years earlier or something like that, and he wrote a piece for piano and orchestra that he calls Rhapsody on a theme by Paganini. So he's taken Paganini's little musical idea, and then he, Rachmaninoff, has developed it into all sorts of wonderful variations. And you you follow because you know the tune, and it's played at the beginning of the piece so you can remember it. But you hear the tune, and it's like a jazz. You know how jazz works. You play the tune, classical jazz. You play the tune, and then everybody riffs on it. Everybody improvises on it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, these are written out improvisations, as it were. These are a kind of intellectual exercise in all the sort of permutations of this thing in terms of rhythm and harmony and melody and all these things, right? So he goes through a whole bunch of different variations and then comes to a stop, and the pianist plays this unbelievable melody that goes da 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 dee da dee da 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 da. Have you ever heard that before? Be da 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 dee da dee da da dee da. You think, where did that come from? That's this beautiful melody. Bill Murray learns to play it in Groundhog Day. Your movie Groundhog Day. Well, he learns to play the piano because he's repeating the day over and over again. Well, eventually he's able to play this fantastic Rachmaninoff. He never played the piano before, but now he can play this fantastic Rachmaninoff tune, right? Okay, well then the question is, what's that got to do with this Rhapsody, I mean this Paganini theme, bon, da 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 dee, da 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 da. Well, it's that tune turned upside down. Think da 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 dee, da 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 da, dum da 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 dee. Turn it around and you get dee da da dee da, dee da da dee da. Can you hear it? Dee da 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 dee da, bong da 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 dee, da 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 dee da. It's the inverse of the thing.
So it was Rachmaninoff riffing on what was the first person?
Paganini.
Paganini. Okay.
Right.
Of course, now if it was happening in 2018, Paganini probably would sue Rachmaninoff for stealing his riff.
It was high. Well, it's more like. All these guys are creating rap songs with stealing little bits of previous recordings, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, but if you find that if you're listening for that kind of thing, you see, and you hear that, and you're asking yourself, how did he get from dum da 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 dee to dee da da dee da, and then you see it. There's this like light bulb that goes on that's the size of the sun. It's astonishing. It's just brilliant. It's like he sees the possibilities in that original Paganini little riff, little tune, and he stretches them out and shows them to everybody. Hmm. It's genius. It's true genius. Beethoven does that all the time in his works, in his symphonies, in his string quartets. He comes up with a little bit of idea of music. Bum, 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 just that little tiny idea of music. And then from that point on, he develops it. Hmm. And it becomes dum, 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 beep, 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 ba, beep, 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 ba. Can you hear that? It's still the bum, 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 ba rhythm. Mm-hmm. But it's moved to other pitches. So it goes ba 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 ti ti da ti ti da 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 ti ti da ti ti da. What? It's all built on that same bum 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 bum. It's all there. And if you listen to that whole piece, it's just this unraveling, not unraveling, it's almost like weaving together all of the possibilities that original four-note little motive had. And it becomes this massive piece of art. It's astonishing. And that's what I'm talking about. When you actually learn to make sense of a piece of music without the external reference points, you know, you could say, that beginning of the Beethoven Fifth Symphony sounds to me like fate knocking at the door. Well, okay. But how about we just think about it as though it were these notes, and these notes follow it, and these notes follow that. Why? And then you see why. You begin to see why. It's like somebody telling a story.
Yeah.
The story just unfolds as it goes.
So every time, you know, I talk to you about something like this, or I listen to you speak at one of our conferences or some conference or something, and you kind of you get into this stuff and you show how different pieces relate to each other or derive, you know, one piece derives from another, at least a part of it derives from another piece. And the way all these things connect, it's so fascinating and interesting, but in a way it's also overwhelming because you have a degree of experience or knowledge that comes with experience that, you can unlock these things, but it also, you know, that's something that any parent or teacher would love to be able to provide for their children. But there is, you know, I don't have that knowledge. And in a way, as much as I'd like to get there, it's intimidating to even know where to begin in some sense. And I suppose I could just sit down and learn as much as I can about Bach or Beethoven or Mozart. But where would you recommend that someone start who's maybe, you know, I don't need to get to where you are. that, you know, that you, that's a calling thing, I think, at least in part. Sure. But, you know, I'd like to know more, or, you know, a lot of people I think would like to know more for, you know, for, if nothing else, for their own sake, right? Their own self-edification, their own education. Right. So where should someone begin when there's this whole, you know, there's centuries and centuries and thousands of pieces of music?
Yeah.
And like, as is the case with literature, you know, where should people begin? Is there a canon in literature that you should, or in music, as there is in literature, that maybe you start with? Like, maybe you tell someone, start with Homer and Shakespeare and see where it takes you. Something like that.
Right.
Is there a similar
right.
thing, or would you recommend learning kinds of music or eras of music or something like that? I mean, that's a pretty wordy question, but what do you think about that?
Well, I guess my first thought is that it would be good to try and get a hold of some of the rudiments of music. So this idea of melody or how it's used, or harmony or form or rhythm or any of the other elements of music. Just like in visual art, you want to begin to understand something about the use of color or line or composition or the medium that is being used in the art. So you learn those things a little. You learn a little bit about those things, and in order to learn about those things, you have to have some examples, you know, some pieces of music to actually dig into.
Right.
One way to do that, I think, would be to read Aaron Copland's book, What to Listen for in Music. Aaron Copland, the famous composer, wrote a book back in the, I think it's the 50s probably, called What to Listen for in Music. And it takes, each chapter is about a different element of music. And at the end of the chapter, he gives you two or three pieces to listen to. He talks about them, you know, in the chapter, and then he'll give you something to listen to, certain recording to listen to. And then, so you
can write it down.
Yeah, that's a good one. And then I think the Leonard Bernstein Young People's Concerts are really valuable for anybody. They don't have to, it's not young people's concerts anymore. It's anybody concerts. But they are old. Back in the, I guess, late 50s, early 60s, he did a whole series of things with the New York Philharmonic. And they were for young people, and it's wonderful because you'll see the cameras pan the audience, and out there, you know, he's talking about these incredibly complicated things, and out there in the audience is this like 9-year-old boy in a suit and tie, you know, sitting, and he's just rapt. He's just in completely engaged with this, you know. And you think, how could we ever get our kids to sit still that long, you know, with that garb in that situation? But he was able to capture their imaginations. And there's a whole series of them. There might be, I don't know, a dozen or so that you can still find, I think.
Were they televised?
Yeah, they were televised.
Okay.
You have to put up with the old technology. Some of them are in black and white, maybe, and some are.
God forbid.
Heavens. But I mean, you know, the grainy sort of sort of television look, but NBC or CBS or somebody like that, filmed them all with the New York Phil. And he does a great job of laying out things. He just is a very engaging teacher.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was my teacher, by the way. That's one of the reasons I'm so interested in it. I studied with him.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, and so I've always loved the way he engaged people with these elements, taking it apart. And he would play little snippets of it, you know. He would say, listen to the horns right here. Would you just play that bit you do here? And they would play it, right? Mm-hmm. And then he'd say, listen for that when we get to that point, and sort of give them signposts, you know, along the way in the midst of the flood of music. I'm mixing my metaphors here. It's overwhelming to listen to a piece for 15 or 20 minutes, you know, without any kind of signposts. But if you have something to sort of park, to grab a hold of, you know, as you go, well then, oh yeah, there's that thing, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I would like to do. So I think maybe that'd be the way to go. And then, sure, it's a great idea to say, well, let's take a particular composer and listen to a lot of things that he did. You know, what did Mozart write? He wrote piano concertos. Well, what's a piano concerto? Well, that leads you into all sorts of information. And what's the difference between a piano concerto and a string quartet? Apart from the fact that one's played by string instruments and the other played by piano, is the music similar in any way? Well, yes, it turns out it is. And what's the difference between a string quartet and a symphony, apart from just the change of instruments? Well, it turns out they're very similar. So if you learn something about one of them, you actually gain information about the others, and you start to see a kind of structure of what Mozart was doing in his life. He certainly wrote all sorts of operas. So you get a little taste of opera, a little taste of chamber music, a little taste of orchestral music, a little taste of choral music. He wrote all sorts of choral music, masses and things. So if you took on one composer like that, you would get a wide variety of different kinds of music, all within the same kind of, I want to say, color palette, because I want to purposely make the transfer to visual art. He used the same kind of formal characteristics in all sorts of different kinds of music. So if you get to know him, you get to know a lot of different things. And then you can say, well, let's look at Prokofiev's music, for example. He'd be a good one to follow, because Prokofiev is what you call a neoclassical composer. He's not a classical composer. He's a 20th century neoclassical composer. At the beginning of the 20th century, some composers like Stravinsky and Erik Satie and Prokofiev went back to away from a kind of romanticized 19th century romantic palette and in forms and colors and so on, and went to back to a kind of Haydn-esque, Mozart-esque clarity and perfection and balance and symmetry and understatement and things like that. Now, Peter and the Wolf is a great example of that. Peter and the Wolf is really a very neoclassical piece. Very elegant and simple and direct and not quite so much hard on the sleeve, pounding passion of Wagner and Mahler and people like that. I'm going on and on. But I think would be interesting to do it. The reason I say Mozart and Prokofiev is because you would see some of the same characteristics, you see. Once you know about Mozart, you'd actually be able to see what Prokofiev was looking back at. Then you could go to, say, somebody like Tchaikovsky or Rimsky-Korsakov or some big Russian romantic composer like that, and you could see the differences. You could see how Mozart's and Prokofiev's melodies are short and crisp and delightful and wry, kind of humorous, you know, and the works of Tchaikovsky's symphonies or his ballets and things have these long, sweeping, romantic melodies. You know, they just go on and on and on, passion and heartbeat and all that stuff. You begin to see differences, you know.
It's a lot of the same ways of learning or studying that I encountered when I was in studying film in college. You learn certain elements of the language, and then you watch a film that is incredibly proficient at exhibiting one of those. Like, they would show you about the classic one is when you're learning the various ways that a shot is framed. You watch Citizen Kane, right? It's the classic because they were so inventive at the time. Sure. And then that takes you, you know, to some other film that was riffing on what Orson Welles was doing in Citizen Kane. And that takes you to someone, you know, in France or in Italy. And then you're comparing Italian neorealism with the French New Wave. And so there's all, you know, the different movements.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's exactly right. What you've done by the way you just described and the way I was describing is you've entered into a kind of tradition.
Yeah.
You know, like we think of, a literary tradition or something. And you once you learn that something about that tradition, then it becomes part of how you do your work in your day. You might be reacting against certain aspects of tradition. You might be embracing certain aspects of the tradition, but you're commenting in a sense on what's gone before. And that's, I think, if you push this to its logical extreme, you get the fifth commandment, frankly. You know, honor your mother and father, not just your biological mother and father, but those who went before you in your field. Those who went before you that made it possible for you to have what you have. This is how things will go well for you. That's what the promise is with that commandment, right?
Yeah.
Honor your mother and father so that things might go well with you. Well, how does things go well with you? They go well with you when you know who you are and where you are in that chain and what you can draw on the wisdom of the past, you know, the whole medieval idea of standing on the shoulders of giants. Was that Bonaventure maybe or somebody like that?
Well,
that's what we're doing, I think. And so you're entering into that tradition. That tradition is actually significant. People do it now in popular music because now there's been 50, 60 years of history. Back in the 60s, there wasn't all that much that they were making a break with the past and they started their own traditions. But then, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and people like that become the grandfathers of a new tradition. And now here we are 50 years later, whatever, and people are living on the benefits, partly, of the kind of harmonic and rhythmic accomplishments of, you know, the Beatles or Elvis Presley or, you know, whoever. So it's the same idea. You just have to know your own history.
Yeah. Okay, so I don't want to keep you too much longer, but I obviously have to ask you to explain about why you don't like the word classical. It's the wrong term.
Well, it's not that I don't like it. It's just that I think it gets misapplied. If you hear people say, do you like classical music? And what they mean is, do you like country music or do you like jazz music or do you like classical music or do you like hip hop music or do you like, you know, like that?
Yeah.
Categories. And the idea that you can make classical music an equivalent category to hip hop music is absurd.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about critiquing hip hop music yet. I might do that if you do. But
that would be a different conversation
But that's not my point here. My point is this: hip hop music has maybe been around 30 years, maybe, if you press it. Okay. Mm. Well, what we say when you say, or do you like classical music? You're talking about when that word classical, you're talking about things like 19th century romanticism, 18th century enlightenment, classical music, that's truly classical music, 17th century Baroque opera, 16th century motets and church masses, 15th and 14th century Ars Nova. I'm going to go into all that, but anyway, it's going from maybe the year, 600 to the year 1955, something like that. Okay. if you want to use that one word to encompass all of that, then you really don't have any idea what you're talking about. Okay. That's not there. There are more styles between 1800 and 2000 in what we call classical music, in those 200 years, then in, I don't know, 10,000 years of popular music, okay?
You know, it's interesting that we do that with music because it doesn't seem like we do that with other art forms to me. Do we do that with painting, for example? Like, do we say everything before, you know, I don't know, 1930 is classical painting? We don't do that. We don't say that. We don't say that everything even before, like, I'll just stretch it and say before the novel was classical literature, but we do that with music. I wonder why that is.
Right. Yeah, I think it's because there is a genuine change of what am I trying to say?
Is it a temperament thing, like the way we think about, the way we thought about music changed?
Partly. I think, see, I think that in the 19th century romanticism inspired the idea of the individual, that the individual and his personal tastes are what decide what is beautiful. And then in the 20th century, with the beginning of the 20th century, you could argue that we gave up God, if you want to just be general about it. We you know, Nietzsche's approach in 1870 or so was to say God is dead. By 1900, he's died himself. But his ideas become the sort of prototype for what's going to become postmodernism, I think, in the 20th century. But then there's a sort of vacuum there. So God is gone, but we still have this romantic idea that the individual's preferences are sacrosanct, as I said at the very beginning. And so music breaks into two sort of streams. The continuation of what we call classical music, continuation of the heritage of Brahms and Wagner and Mahler and Bruckner and into the 20th century, carries on in some various ways, but it becomes, over the course of the next 50 years, before the end of the Second World War, it becomes increasingly esoteric. Ivory Tower composers writing for other Ivory Tower composers. Mm. It doesn't actually speak to the individual person anymore. When Beethoven wrote a symphony, the public in general wanted to go and hear it. It's hard for us to understand that, but that was a big event. People wanted to go and hear the latest work that Beethoven had written. But in the 20th century, you know, Karlheinz Stockhausen, nobody knows him. He's a 50s composer, 1950s composer. A small handful of musicians, and they were sort of electronic musicians. They weren't even, you know, orchestral people. They were electronic musicians, were interested in his latest accomplishments. It's just left the realm of the popular altogether, and that left a big vacuum. And in that vacuum, we started seeing the influence of the blues and eventually big band music, and the blues becomes rock and roll in the 50s and so on, and you get this sort of rise of popular music.
Jazz,
in the 20th century. Jazz actually, yeah, jazz is in between the two of them. Jazz can be very popular and also at the same time be very artistically profound, I think.
Yeah. It seems like poetry is in a similar spot now, where it almost is like the people who really like the great poets are people who are poets.
Right. That's right. Emily Dickinson still has a little bit of popularity, maybe, but T.S. Eliot understood that things were fragmenting, things were falling apart. Yeats and so on at the beginning of the 20th century recognized that things were coming apart. The center couldn't hold, is Yeats's famous line, right? Eliot's Wasteland is a fragmentation of the world, of this heritage I'm talking about that people need to regain. So he picked and chose from all the various books of all the various, you know, history of the world, Eastern and Western, and he sewed them together to make up a poem about how we're living in a wasteland. And that's what they saw at the beginning of the 20th century. They're very prophetic. I think it's happened. I think we've seen it. So people's lives actually are no longer connected to the kinds of progressive musical thought, you know, what's the next step in the sort of evolution of music on that kind of level. Nobody cares about that. Nobody listens to that. There was one exception to that. Back in the 70s, a Polish composer named Henryk Gorecki wrote a symphony, his third symphony, and it became so popular that it was selling out in the rock and roll shops, the CD shops in the 90s in England and in America, especially in England. They would have these fantastic pictures of guys with, you know, red mohawks and safety pins through their cheeks and things going in and buying this symphony by this Polish composer. Huh. But it's called Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. And it really caught the popular mind again. That was a very strange and unusual thing. But that doesn't happen. Like I say, that's rare.
Well, I should let you go. So I want to end with just a couple of kind of quicker questions here. Is there a piece of music that you have recently discovered or rediscovered that has caught your attention, maybe surprised you, or just you've been enamored with?
I do love the Prokofiev ballet score to Romeo and Juliet.
How do you spell Prokofiev?
Yeah, P-R-O-K-O-F-I-E-V.
Okay.
Prokofiev. And he wrote in the 30s, probably early 30s, a brilliant, brilliant ballet score to tell the story of Romeo and Juliet. And it is priceless, just priceless. I've always loved it, but I have kind of rediscovered it lately. I conducted a performance of Smetana's piece, The Moldau, a year or so ago. And I began to realize that that really is a fine little piece of music. And it's a good piece if people want to, as an entry-level piece. That is, I was talking about music that has a program, you know, and this piece is about, in a sense, sailing down the Moldau River from its source all the way to the sea. And the various segments of the music are kind of interpretations of what it felt like to go down the river, you see. Here's the rapids, and here's the nightfall with the stars, and here's the, you know, the wedding on the bank. We went by a little peasant wedding, and you hear peasant music in the back, and so on.
Are most of these pieces available on things like Spotify?
Sure. And you can find them on YouTube too. You can see an orchestra play them if you want to.
That's
live. That's kind of fun. It's always nice to see the players actually making the music, I think.
Great for driving, but otherwise better.
No. Sit and watch it go by, but then when you go, if you go in your car, then take the audio and listen to that. Then you can listen to it again, because all these repay and repeated listenings.
Okay, my last question. What are you reading right now that you that's taken you by surprise, or that you're just particularly enamored with? I'll put it that way again.
Yeah. Let's see. Frederick Bastiat's The Law. Have you read that?
I have not.
Yeah, Bastiat, B-A-S-T-I-A-T. Thin little book on the law, the purpose of the law, and I'll let you look at it and see what you think. But that's about politics, in a sense. It's a 19th century book, but it speaks to everything that's going on in the political sphere today. Really fascinating.
All right. Well, before we let you go, you gotta plug the Center for Western Studies a little bit. What's going on? What are you guys up to over there?
Right. We're having such a great time. The Center for Western Studies, for those who don't know, is a gap year program for kids who want to take a year off between high school and college to study two things: a Christian view of the world and the history of Western ideas through the humanities, through the arts mainly, and philosophy. So we start reading in Homer at the beginning of the year, and we work our way all the way to T.S. Eliot and G.K. Chesterton, C.S. Lewis, basically anybody that has two first initials.
That's the parameters, the requirements.
Well, Hemingway too, I guess. We do Hemingway and Conrad and people like that. But we usually get up to the beginnings of what we call the postmodern literary theory, which is maybe 1950s, 60s, that kind of thing. Poems of postmodern poems. But interspersed with the great books, you know, the Aeschylus and Dante and Shakespeare and so on, we also talk about painting and visual art, architecture and sculpture, and we talk about music. And we have about six on the faculty who carry the heavy load with literature for the most part, and I do the art and music and philosophy stuff. And together we give them what we think is a good foundation to go anywhere they want to go and to college without feeling like they have to give up their faith in order to seriously study in their academic fields. So it's a gap year like that. What we're doing right now, where we are right now, is We're reading Erasmus. We've just read In Praise of Folly. Lots of fun. And now we're reading his debate with Luther over free will. Erasmus, you know, held one side and Luther held the other about whether the will is free to choose to follow God. And it's a fascinating debate and a great study in rhetoric, frankly, but also an interesting theological debate. And then next week, I think we've got Luther and Calvin. We're in the middle of the Northern Renaissance. That's why we're dealing with Erasmus and Luther and Calvin. Just finished up with Shakespeare. Next, I think we'll go into the 18th century and we'll talk about Swift and Voltaire and Rousseau and people like that.
Well, I know that I wish that this program had been around when I was graduating high school. I definitely would have.
I wish somebody had put me through it. I think it would have been great for me. That'd be fine. And if people are interested in knowing more about it, I should tell you this too, because this is always something that attracts people. In the spring every year, I take them to Europe. So we rent an apartment in London and we rent an apartment in Paris. And we go over there and we spend time in the museums and the cathedrals and the concert halls and go to shows in the West End and like that. We go to Chartres Cathedral and we go to Oxford and see where the Inklings met and, you know, various sort of things like that. So they get a little taste of actually some of the places that we talk about during the year in person.
I always get so jealous when I see the photos you guys post on social media.
Oh, yeah. It's a great trip. It's a great trip. So if people are interested in that, we ought to say, you know, they can find us on our website at centerws.com, centerws.com. And that's Center for Western Studies.
Well, Mr. Hodges, thank you for joining us. We look forward to having you back at the conference this summer. So anybody who is going to be meeting us in Charleston will see you there. And I'm sure you'll get pinned down by somebody that has some kind of question about this podcast. So,
I'd love to talk to anybody about this more. And I can't wait to be there at the CRC conference this summer. I've always enjoyed that. And I'm deeply impressed by what you and your dad have done and all of those that work with you. So keep up the good work.
Well, likewise. Thank you.
And let me be a part as I can be. I'm always honored to be a part.
We'll have to get you come back on to talk particularly about how to deal with pop music. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are interested in that. So maybe we can have a part 2 sometime in the next month or something.
I'd love it. Anytime, David. Anytime.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.